This episode of Energy Matters is sponsored by Arnold Golden and Gregory.
Welcome to Energy Matters, a show about how you can save money on your utility bills, use technology wisely, and live a more sustainable lifestyle. Here's your host, veteran energy regulator and clean energy expert, Commissioner Tim Echols.
And thank you, Scott Slade. It's always a great day to be saving money and talking sustainability.
Money.
And technology. I'm Tim Echols, the host of Energy Matters. My co-host today, John Noel.
Your crooner today, John Noel.
Yeah, good to see you, John. How's it going?
Oh, man, I'd love being here.
Yeah, this is a fun thing. We have the basically the brain trust of sustainability coming through our studio, and we kid about giving continuing education credits for our listeners.
Yes.
And our listeners are growing. Folks are tuning into WGAURadio.com, and they're downloading on demand the podcast from our previous shows, and we welcome you to do that. To follow us on Twitter at Matters Radio. I'm also at Tim Echols, and John,
New Energy Guy.
And in the studio today, Patrick Ballard again. Patrick, great to have you back.
Thanks, Tim. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, you're a UGA alum, and more importantly, you've served our country in the Air Force. You retired as a colonel. Thank you so much for your service.
My pleasure.
We appreciate that. I have a son in the Coast Guard, a daughter in the Justice Department, and another son that serves as a police officer. And so I really appreciate folks that lay their life on the line, and it's just something that we don't talk enough about. Well, John, we're going to talk today about a big part of the U.S. budget, and that is military spending.
Yep.
Department of Defense. And folks may or may not know that Georgia has the largest cache of solar on Department of Defense facilities than any other state.
Did not know this.
Yeah, so no matter where you go in our state, I was recently in Albany, and the Marine base has solar there. And in fact,
like megawatts, like a whole bunch of them.
Yeah, like 30 megawatts
in
most of these bases.
Wow.
And some of the bases are getting even more than that. The Air Force Base in Warner Robins getting an even bigger piece of that. And so, Patrick, as you think about solar on these bases in Georgia, I mean, you've spent a lot of time on military bases.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you see that as something important, having it right there on the ground inside the fence on the base?
Well, it would be important just from a redundancy standpoint, really. I mean, in the mix of legacy on-grid energy, as well as having the ability to have backup, and we're always having a backup need for power in the event of a natural disaster or some other type of event that takes away your primary power. You always want to have a backup capability. To date, it's largely been through large diesel generators for your command nodes and the critical parts of a base.
But the rest of the base is down. And
correct.
Then you're relying on the generators working.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. So, in the mix of things, at a minimum, I could see renewable and sustainable energy sources like that, maybe spreading out the use of mitigating the use of diesel power generators for backup power.
Or let it be a redundancy to the redundancy.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Mm. So that you have a higher reliability rate of your power for your critical command nodes on a
well,
base.
Well, I was with Colonel Trimble. He is one of the base, commanders down in Albany at the Marine base recently. And he was talking about energy security and energy resilience. And when you think about energy security from a Department of Defense perspective, what does that mean when you hear an Army guy or a Air Force guy, gal, say energy security? What are they talking about?
Well, primarily what would come to my head is sort of what I already alluded to. The operating a DoD operation of any type, no matter what branch you're in, is very energy
intensive.
That's right. And so one of the ways that you can interrupt a mission is to cut the energy. And so you want to have a secure means or a means of securing your energy source, your energy resources. And in the event of a failure of that, you want to have the resiliency to either be down a minimal amount of time or not be down at all in the event of a power interruption.
So when you think about solar and how that might be deployed in theater, right? So I hear about these convoys of fuel trucks, right? That are coming and bringing, I guess, diesel or jet fuel or different things, and how the enemy likes to hit these things. And so I guess they focus on that. I mean, is there a place, do you think, for extensive solar in theater, getting that out there? I mean, I realize that only works in the daytime, but we do have batteries, and those could be transported, right? So it's a logistical thing. I mean, do you see this changing for DOD as these resources get cheaper?
I think it's maybe not so much as it gets cheaper, but as it gets easier to move. So as technology advances...
Right, you're the military. And, you don't care about dollars.
Well, you do, and we're responsible for it. However, you still, in a contingency operation, you have to get your stuff from point A to point B. And so if you have a solar farm, this is probably what the layperson is bringing to mind when you're talking about power. Any kind of lay down like that takes up a lot of space. And so for a logistician, you have to figure out how you can get all of that equipment and all of your food and other supplies and materials into theater and get it set up. And so, you know, is it cost efficient? Is it cost effective? Is it mission effective and mission efficient? Does it enhance your ability and capability, or does it not? So there's a calculus that goes into figuring out, is it a good fit? And if it is, as technology and engineering advances, the capability to collapse something into a smaller space and expand it, then you will probably see that. Because again, you know, supply interdiction goes back thousands of years, right? And so
supply interdiction meaning
hitting the enemy's critical node of getting being able to supply themselves with whatever it is they got to supply themselves, whether it's fuel or food or what have you. So in the grand scheme of things, in the mix, if you can have that redundancy, like we referred to earlier, of a renewable energy source that is available where you are going to, you just have to have the means to capture that, like a solar or like a wind turbine. That may be a smaller scale. There are certain applications where that may be a good fit, and as they can, you know, plan for it either on a ship or on and have the lead time to get that off a ship to the location, or plan for it to be floor loaded on a C-5, for example, or a C-17, and get it into theater quickly and then unpack it and get it to where it needs to go, that's going to be a critical calculation that takes place. And engineering those solutions will be a part of that.
So when we think about energy usage, I mean, I I've been to bases and I've seen, you know, it's basically a city. Right, it's not much difference, but
that's right.
I haven't been out there in theater, you know, with troops out in the middle of, you know, a desert. I mean, when we think about energy usage for troops out there in an Afghanistan or in Iraq, I mean, what does that look like? I mean, is it a bunch of generators out there with tents and little light bulbs hanging down from the ceiling, or is it mobile homes or campers?
What
is that energy use look like out there? Would you call that the front or in theater? I mean,
in the front. I mean, I did Bagram Airfield in Afghanistan, and so a lot
you
of
say
your,
you did it. Tell me about that.
I deployed. I was the 455th Expeditionary Maintenance Squadron commander at Bagram in the winter and spring 2007. And so when we were there, you had a lot of contractors there that were supporting the infrastructure of Bagram. And it requires a lot of power. I mean, you got to feed thousands of people that are in a tight space. You have to bathroom them. You got to bed them. I mean, there's the whole lodging piece. And
hot showers.
Yep, hot showers, hot meals, and everything that goes along with that. And so a lot of your power is generated through either contracted through the local authorities or backed up with a lot of diesel power. And I think you're already starting to see, to some degree, there will be some renewable energy resources that will be applied to that.
So when you think about waste of energy or how you might do it differently, I mean, you're out now, right? And you're in the, you know, you're in the efficiency business. So, I mean, if you could wave a magic wand over this you know, this encampment in theater, how would you make it more efficient? What would be a couple of things that you would do now to essentially use less diesel fuel or to use a different type of energy or to make the operation, even through the acquisition of whatever the equipment is or the housing is, how would you make it more efficient?
Well, I'll tell you what I would do. One thing that I've been thinking through here recently with a couple of contractors is out in the forward operating bases in Afghanistan. So these small, you know, contingencies that are pushed way out at the end of the hub and spoke, right? And you have maybe a battery of Marines that are in place, or maybe 100 people out there, and they're on an island, right? And so to make them self-sufficient and totally cut off from being interdicted with their power, you could have a hybrid photovoltaic solar cell combined with a wind turbine type of a system that maybe is in a sea container. And everything is kitted up inside the sea container. You could break that open, set up your solar panels and your wind turbines, and in a day you'd have a series of batteries stored up with power, and you operate the small base off of that unit. You may have
and the,
two
and the
or
batteries
five
get dropped in full, so
that's
the batteries
right.
are already in there.
That's
I mean,
right.
I love that deal.
So you know, I'm thinking through solutions like that that I can maybe bring to the DOD.
Yeah, when we come back, John, I want to continue our conversation about DOD. I mean, it is such an important aspect of our culture. I want to, you know, just ask how realistic is electrifying stuff out there? I want to get into that.
You know planes. Could we have electric planes?
Yeah. Don't answer that right now. But when we come back, let's continue this conversation with Patrick Ballard. I'm Tim Echols, and you're listening to Energy Matters.
The electric car revolution is coming, and the choices are growing. GEM cars are everywhere. You've seen these low-speed electric vehicles on college campuses, downtown Atlanta streets, and resort islands like St. Simons and Jekyll. GEM cars are street legal, equipped with seatbelts, headlights, and a tag, and can operate on roads with speed limits of 35 miles per hour or less. If you want to know more about these electric cars and trucks, six-passenger shuttles, mobile repair service, or full vehicle wraps, go to GEMCarService.com. That's GEMCarService.com.
John, one of our sponsors for the show, Rowe Insulating Company, is doing a great job in and around Athens, being able to do a lot of what we talk about every single week on the show.
Every time it gets cold, every time it gets hot, it's always that attic that's the problem. And you could attack windows, and that's going to cost you a cold fortune. It is insulation that can solve the problem.
Hey, if you want to get this fixed, call 706-795-2854. That's 706-795-2854. Rowe Insulating Company.
Rowe.
Support for Energy Matters comes from Arnold, Golden, and Gregory. AGG takes a business sensibility approach when advising clients. AGG provides industry knowledge, attention to detail, transparency, and value to help businesses and individuals achieve their definition of success. AGG subscribes to the belief, not if, but how. We appreciate their weekly support of Energy Matters.
Hey, this is Tim Echols, host of Energy Matters. I'm back, and I've got in the studio with me my co-host, John Newell. John, how's it going?
Yes, sir.
Good to have everybody along today. We've got Patrick Ballard in studio, and Patrick's on Twitter as well. Patrick, you're at A Omnisource, is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, and you served in the Air Force. You've been deployed overseas, and you've got some experience with logistics and folks out there, you know, listening, and we're talking about coordination of resources. And obviously, I mean, it's hard enough, John, for me to coordinate resources at my own house, you know, let alone
true that
out in some godforsaken, you know, desert somewhere where you guys are serving. My son serves in the Coast Guard in Valdez, Alaska.
Nice.
And I can tell you, from having gone there and driven the 5.5 hours from the nearest Walmart, that place is way out there. So, Patrick, thank you for serving our country, for putting yourself in harm's way to protect our freedom. You know, John, I think we just don't say thank you enough to the folks that are out there serving us and giving us an opportunity to live life and make the choices that we make.
That's true. That's true. But you know what we're talking about, sustainability, energy, Will help us, frankly, in my opinion, get the heck out of places where we can let them fight amongst themselves and we can make our own energy. And that's the beauty of it. I mean, being a good steward of your energy is not just the right thing to do for your wallet, not the right thing to do for the planet, not the right thing to do ethically. It's also the right thing to do for our people serving that, in my opinion, are serving in places that we get into because we don't have energy independence.
You know, John, you and I have never talked about this, and I've never really thought about it that much. But as we talk to Patrick and I think about this move away from Middle Eastern oil.
Yeah.
Right.
That's why I drive an electric car. I don't want to give the Saudis any money.
To American natural gas,
yeah.
American electricity. I wonder how this will change geopolitical thought in the world, right? Will we need to, I guess, have the muscle that we've had over there to protect those oil resources in the same way? Will it, you know, as we think about 20 years, 50 years down the road, let's say that we do move more and more towards electric transportation.
Yeah.
Let's just hypothetically say that in 100 years.
100 that, years?
That, listen to me.
Yeah, not with you.
That in 100 years, that 90% of the cars in America are running on electricity.
Not 90, 100.
How does that, there will be some holdouts. There's always some holdouts.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, the 57 Chevrolets are still going to be
true.
Classic cars.
That's true.
Okay?
That's true.
Don't forget.
True.
So how does that impact, you know, our Department of Defense, our Senate, our House, our President's philosophy, you know, over national security in the Middle East? I mean, Patrick, you giving that any thought? I mean, that's way hypothetical.
That's some deep stuff there, Tim. That's seeing way over the horizon. You know, having been part of the Air Force, you know, a lot of what we do is very, very fuel dependent, right? I mean, F-15, F-16, F-22, B-52, B-2, B-1, C-5, C-70, all these aircraft got to have fuel.
You know, jet fuel, right?
Jet fuel, correct. Uh-huh. JP-8, straight 8. There's a lot of, there's a couple of variants, but it is very fuel intensive. Now, you know, if the national draw on fuel shrinks to the point where all of the DOD's fuel could be derived from American sources, so, you know, that would be a game changer. And we may eventually get there. Couldn't tell you, couldn't prognosticate when that might happen. It might be in that 100 years.
We tend to follow our wallets. And so when there's money at stake, that's what happens. And insofar as planes, right now, my Tesla's at a 250 watt hours per kilogram of juice per kilogram. A jet, now this is commercial, not your fancy fighter jets, but a commercial jet needs 400 watt hours per kilogram to fly, or 500 being more ideal. So, you know, we're not that far off from like electric planes. I teased that earlier, but I think it's becoming a real possibility.
Yeah, let's go to what we talked about at the end of the segment about electrifying things in theater. I mean, is it realistic, Patrick, to think that maybe we could have an electric tank one day or an electric Humvee? Or is that just really too risky out there in a place where I don't know if I'm going to be able to get back to charge this? I mean, either way, you've got to fill that thing with something, right?
Correct.
I mean, unless you were running it on nuclear power, right? Like a submarine, right? A nuclear tank.
Well, it may be that you'd start to see on a smaller scale some of the drones that are out there, right? That are performing either ISR or intelligence, you know, reconnaissance type missions. So you've got a lighter aircraft that takes less power to get airborne. And you aren't really hanging a lot of things on the aircraft other than electronics. There's some that are carrying some weaponry. When you get to
bombs. I mean, you know, Saudi Arabia was a beneficiary of that, and that had to get across the Strait of Hormuz.
Right. But that I guarantee you that drone it was fueled by, you know, jet fuel of some sort, some kind of JP-8 type of a fuel. But you know, you're starting to see electronic components though come about, like the 787 Dreamliner from Boeing has incorporated a lot of electronics in the fuselage. They're touting their all electronic fuselage, and it has actually allowed the jet to shed some weight elsewhere. So a lot of the electronics on board for the pressurization system and a number of other things have allowed them to shed bleed air valves and piping off of the engines, the tubing off the engines, that a traditional or older version of their jets are using bleed air and a lot of conduits, which weighs a lot, to
so
bleed
efficient.
Energy off of the yep. off of the engine. Yep. Right.
Bleed,
so it's more
bleed air. What is bleed air again?
Bleed air is air that comes off of an engine. You know, it's exhaust, and you're capturing that air that to turn other things. And so when you don't need that level of air to operate other things, you can shed that tubing, and it you shed weight off the aircraft, and therefore you require less thrust to get the aircraft airborne. So now, you know, there's a trade-off with, like we keep alluding to, the batteries. You know, the batteries weigh a lot. But as technology advances, batteries improve, things are smaller, lighter, you may start to see more and more parts of Boeing's aircraft offerings, for example, become more electric in nature. Not sure we'll ever get to an electronic turbofan engine out there. That's a lot of mass out there to move with a battery versus aircraft fuel. But who knows? I mean, we may crack the code on something in the next 50 years.
Let me ask you this. SEAL Team is one of my favorite shows, you know, that I watch on TV. And
you're not the only one.
The FBI, yeah. I like that. Yeah. I mean, I'm into these things. But I know, like, on SEAL Team, they have this, they talk about Overwatch, right, with a sniper. And then they've got these drones that are giving some kind of Overwatch, like infrared stuff. Are those, one, is that a real thing? And two, are those drones electric that are low down there giving that infrared stuff, or would those be jet fuel powered drones, do you think?
Typically right now those are going to be jet fuel powered, and there may be some out there that have more electric power for the purposes of flight than I know. I don't have direct experience with drones, but I know I slept in a Holiday Inn Express last night, so I know somewhat about the mechanics of it. But there are a lot of electronics on the aircraft, and to your question a second ago also about Overwatch and some of the camera type capabilities, there is a lot of infrared. We've been using forward-looking infrared cameras for decades, so that technology is out there. Even the B-52 has it, so that technology has been out there for quite a while, and it's continuously being refined. And as it gets smaller and smaller, a drone can carry more and more of it and can capture masses of data. So whether it's a reconnaissance mission overseas in a theater of operation somewhere, or along the border at the southern border or the northern border, or if it's drug interdiction, you know, that those are all applications.
Wow.
For that.
As we wrap up this segment with you, I know I wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal that made the case about national security and nuclear energy. I was pitching Plant Vogel and the importance of us continuing.
And it was well argued. I disagreed with it, but it was well argued.
Thank you. Just continuing our dominance. And in this article, I cited the importance of nuclear dominance in America for military, right? Battleships, submarines, aircraft carriers. I mean, how important is superiority, right? And using a technology like that allows a submarine to basically stay underwater, you know, for a very long time and power itself. How important is nuclear energy and the military?
Well, it depends on, from an energy standpoint, it's important. Obviously, the Navy uses it to a great degree. The other services don't use it to the extent that the Navy does. And it does give you the ability to operate for very extended periods of time without having to refuel. And that's a game changer. And so anytime you can achieve a level of dominance like that, where you can guarantee your superiority in a battlefield situation, you're never going to want to give that up. You never want to go into a contingency, God forbid we have to do that, and not be assured of a win. And so every kind of leverage you can give yourself to include that is going to be
project
applied.
Our power.
That's correct. That's
it.
Correct.
Wow. Patrick, thank you for your service to our country and for being a part of Energy Matters today. We really appreciate what you're doing, and we appreciate all our troops out there. We want to continue to help them to be the most effective they can. I'm Tim Echols, and you're listening to Energy Matters.
Gas South believes in the difference we can all make, like the difference in putting people first and showing that you care. For us, our difference is saving people money with our best rates and no deposit, and the difference we make in our community by taking care of our friends and neighbors and giving back 5% of our profits to help children in need. Learn more about what makes us different at GasSouth.com. Gas South, the difference is good.
Creative Solar USA is a Georgia-based turnkey installer of innovative solar panel systems. They're dedicated to energy solutions for both your home and business. With their NABCEP certified installers, they ensure their clients receive the highest quality of solar energy systems in the industry. Contact CSUSA today at 770-485-7438 or go to creativesolarusa.com.
This episode of Energy Matters is sponsored by Energy and Environment. We interrupt this episode of Energy Matters to take you outdoors.
On the road again.
Hey, this is Tim Eccles with Energy Matters on the road, and got an opportunity to have this half of the show dedicated to continued discussion about Department of Defense as well as nuclear energy in the U.S. And with me today is Ed Davis. He has a consulting company called Pegasus. So let me ask first, Ed, how did you come up with that name for this company?
Well, I had run a company in Atlanta handling what they call spent uranium fuel that comes from a nuclear power plant. That was a startup adventure, and the company was sold, and I was looking for something to do. And it's a Greek name. It has some implications about adventure and challenges, and so I thought it was appropriate to what I was setting myself up to do.
Well, in the first half of the show today, we talked about the Air Force in particular with a guest and some of the technologies, strategies that the Air Force is deploying and DOD in general. But you know, it seems like that it's been the Navy that's really taken advantage of nuclear energy from the beginning and continues to do that today, right? Is that, am I getting this right?
No, I think historically that's correct. I mean, the father of the commercial nuclear industry is Admiral Rickover, who following World War II saw the advantage of using nuclear energy as a propulsion system for submarines, and went about developing the first nuclear-powered submarine called the Nautilus. And actually, from design to in the water, I think it took about 5 to 6 years. An amazing short period of time compared to how long it takes to build nuclear power plants today.
So the Nautilus and other nuclear submarines, they actually have a reactor with fuel. They stay underwater for a very long time, and they're powered not just the engine, but all their lights and their climate controls. Everything's powered by that reactor?
Everything's powered by that reactor. You know, they have, in many cases, they'll maybe have one or two. Aircraft carriers, for example, have as many as four reactors on board. But they those systems are designed to provide the entire power load for those ships that are out at sea for long periods of time without refueling.
So if we didn't have that, let's say that we had some president put an executive order, a ban on any kind of nuclear in America, and those, I guess those vessels could go back to diesel. How would it impact the Navy if submarines and aircraft carriers had diesel engines instead of nuclear-powered engines?
Well, I would just comment that obviously it's twofold. One, strategically, having the advantage of not having to come back to port for refueling is a tactical and strategic advantage for those ships. But I mean, the fact that the nuclear propulsion systems that the Navy uses now has dramatically changed and provided the United States with higher levels of defense than anything we could imagine right after World War II.
You know,
it's unimaginable to have to go back to using fossil fuels to drive our large capital ships.
You know, as you think about America and our involvement in nuclear energy, I know I've written an article in the Wall Street Journal about this. You know, tying into not only the energy security, but national security and the importance of America maintaining kind of a superior position. I mean, if you had to come up with a couple of reasons why America needs to be involved in the nuclear business, I mean, what would be some of the key takeaways for you?
Well, I think it's obvious that we brought the technology, we invented the technology, we made it available to other nations around the world, beginning with Eisenhower's famous Atoms for Peace speech before the United Nations in 1954. Today, the U.S. has probably the strongest and most stringent regulatory system that oversees the nuclear power industry in the United States and ensures, as a result of that regulatory system, ensures the highest levels of safety that we see around the world. As a matter of fact, U.S.-operated nuclear power plants that we have today, which is about 97, just under 100, probably have year-long capacity factors in the order of 95%. In other words, they're running 24/7, 95% of the time, which is really one of the highest standards, if not the highest standard in the world. And the reason why we need to continue to be involved in this industry is that our presence sets the bar on what the expectations and requirements are for maintaining levels of safety, safety in operations, safety in design, et cetera, et cetera.
I haven't had a chance to go to Russia yet. I did go to Shanghai and have a chance to visit with the Chinese to hear as much as they would tell us about their plans, which included their own little version of Yucca Mountain that they are that they showed us a PowerPoint about. I had a chance to go to Haiyang and visit a couple of the AP1000 reactors, just like the ones we're building here in Georgia. But it seems like the Chinese are really moving very quickly to nuclear energy, as well as Russia. Why is it so important for them to move in this direction so quickly?
Well, I think Russia and China are moving towards nuclear energy, or have seen an emphasis on nuclear energy, largely for two different reasons. Let's take China first. China has an enormous air pollution problem. It's just almost unimaginable, the levels of pollution. I'm told by people that visit that country, and you may have seen this yourself firsthand during your visit, that there are times in of the day in Peking, for example, that you can't hardly see because there's so much smog. And as a result of that, there is a huge pushback by the common people in China trying to get the government's attention to try to dramatically reduce the levels of air pollution and smog in China. And the one way the Chinese believe they can do that, and they're correct, is through greater use of nuclear power. And that is really the driver behind the Chinese nuclear program today. On the other hand, Russia sees nuclear energy as a means to cementing its relationships with the developing third world countries that want to access the advantages of nuclear power around the world. And they see this as a means to lock in an 80 to 100 year relationship by offering them not only the nuclear plant, but also the supply of nuclear fuel, as well as taking back any of the nuclear waste for periods up to 80 to 100 years. So it really ties the two countries together, Russia and the developed country together, in ways that may not be advantageous to the United States.
So I guess in a way, Russia and the U.S. are competing on the world market for any number of technologies, like you're mentioning, nuclear energy. I was visiting with some folks from Israel, and they were talking about the importance of the U.S. lifting an embargo on Crete and allowing Crete to have U.S. military technology, something as simple as night vision goggles, which they haven't been able to use. What these countries are apparently forced to do, if the U.S. is not able to work with them, they go to Russia, and so maybe they're buying their planes, maybe they're buying their night vision goggles, their weapon, their ammunition. So if the U.S. gets out of the nuclear business, then what are the choices that people have in the world? I mean, is it just Russia, China, India?
Well, largely that's the case. South Korea, for example. I mean, we live in a world. I mean, technology is not locked up in a, you know, hermetically sealed in some secret vault someplace. It's largely available in these countries, which are have technological capabilities of their own, which rival ours in some cases, the Chinese, as well as the Russians, have great scientific programs, both in space and nuclear technology and in computer capabilities. So, you know, if we're not involved in the further development of this technology, those countries obviously will see that to their advantage and take over from us.
For the last part of this,
fill the void, I might add.
For the last part of this segment, speaking of space and military procurement, I want to just talk about how military and space procurement have impacted quality of life in America and around the world. So, as you think of some of the ways that this has happened, maybe that our listeners don't know about, what are some of the things that come to your mind when you think about how military and space procurement or technology has made an impact?
Well, to me, it seems to be, I'm sort of a child of Sputnik, and that is when Sputnik, when the Russians launched their Sputnik satellite, being the first, I was still in either high school, and there was a rush to encourage all of the students and that were coming up in from high school into college to get into engineering and science degrees. The way I see it is, you know, it's almost incalculable the number of ways that we benefit from the space program or some of the other military procurements that have been made around the world. Computers are a direct descendant from the space program. You know, transistors. All of our world today, some of the materials, for instance, like plastics and high-strength carbon, have largely been developed based on the military development programs. So our well-being, our well-being and our future well-being has directly benefited from the development of those technologies.
Well, when we come back, I want us to talk about this whole idea of quality of life and well-being. I want to talk a little bit more about some of the things that DOD may do out in theater, microreactors, other things like that. I want us to talk about the per capita consumption of electricity and the kind of indicator that is for quality of life. So stick around. I'm Tim Echols. You're listening to Energy Matters on the Road. Tim Echols here for Solar Sun World. No doubt you've seen solar panels popping up all over Georgia. If you want the precision of German engineering when it comes to solar, Solar Sun World is for you. The folks there understand the complexities of solar and how to make it work, from tax credits to inverters to accelerated depreciation. They'll unpack it all. They've been in business for over 25 years. To find out more, go to solarsunworld.com. That's solarsunworld.com. Hey, it's Commissioner Tim Echols, host of Energy Matters. I want to tell you about Kevin Rowe and Rowe Insulating Company. If you need insulation anywhere within 60 miles of Athens, Georgia, you need to call 706-795-2854. It's important, isn't it, John?
It is the most important thing you can do in your house.
It's the low-hanging fruit of everything that we talk about on Energy
right.
Matters every single week.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, call 706-795-2854. That's 706-795-2854. Rowe Insulating Company.
Get comfortable.
Energy Matters would like to thank Gas South for its support of the show. Gas South has a no-deposit policy and offers some of the lowest per-therm rates in the state. Use the promo code MATTERS for a special deal. Gas South, the difference is good.
This half hour of Energy Matters is sponsored by Energy and Environment. Energy and Environment's commercial, industrial, and government efficiency contracting services lower utility bills for their customers. And we talk a lot about that on Energy Matters. They specialize in custom lighting, retrofit solutions, and a lot of other stuff. Energy and Environment brings over 20 years of experience to your place of work. See what they can do for you at Energy and Environment. Spell out the word energyandenvironment.com.
Hey, this is Tim Echols. I'm still on the road with Energy Matters. I'm interviewing today Ed Davis of Pegasus Consulting. And Ed, you kind of live the life like a congressman. You fly to Washington on Sunday or Monday and come back on Thursday. I mean, you're a frequent flyer for sure. Is it, you know, just a little personal stuff, is it tough living that kind of a life?
Well, I've become accustomed to it. You know, at first I thought it was being away for, you know, 3 or 4 days constantly, week by week, would be tough. But I found the work up in Washington, again, very exciting. I've been involved in the development of nuclear power and Department of Energy, and it's been something that's kept me interested and busy. So I've enjoyed it.
Well, it's great having you as one of my constituents living over here, not too far from where my wife went to high school up in North Fulton County. I teased this segment here at the end of the previous segment about this whole per capita consumption of electricity data and it being an indicator of quality of life or well-being. And you and I were talking before this interview about how you measure that in toasters. And I thought that was interesting to think about how it's measured in toasters. And it's the comparison of how much we consume here in the U.S. compared to, say, China and India. Kind of share that with our listeners.
Well, it's an interesting analogy, and I can't take credit for myself. This comes from the former chief technology officer for Bill Gates, who has put a paper in Scientific American basically analogizing the per capita, that means the individual and individual's consumption of electricity. And it's a measurement of what the scientists say is well-being and longevity. And basically, he equates it to about, on the average, 10 to 11, and I say use the word 10, I use the number 10 because it's convenient, 10 toasters round the clock. That's what an average individual consumes in the amount of electricity on a yearly basis in the United States. And so I always ask the question when we start talking about the future of the world's use of electricity, what someone's guess is in terms of the per capita consumption of electricity, for instance, in China or in India. And I think I asked you, Tim, about what's your guess in terms of China. You came out pretty close. You said 4. The actual number is 3. And for India, it's about 1.5. But the whole point of that is saying that those two countries, which have massive amount of population and it's growing very rapidly, they are going to want to increase their standard of living. And the way they're going to have to do that is to increase their per individual's consumption of electricity up to the level that we're accustomed to today. We live in a society today in the United States that has one of the highest levels of well-being. We have one of the longest longevity for our lifespans. So other countries are going to aspire to this standard. They're going to want to increase their 3 toasters or 1.5 toasters per individual up to our 10. That's not to say, obviously, and their populations are expanding at the same time. All this means that we're going to have massive increases in amount of power plants around the world. And in order to do that, we're going to have to come up with an energy source that doesn't pollute and doesn't exacerbate our climate problem. And to me, that choice of future power source is increased reliance on nuclear power, unquestionably.
I've had a chance to go to Munich and Berlin, Ed, and the Germans are quite proud of their energy transition process. And one of the surprises to me is their closure of nuclear power plants before they close coal plants. So they're going to close out all their nuclear energy in 2022, they say. I believe that they probably will do it. This other figure, though, of closing out the coal by 2038 is something that they seem to be less sure of. They really don't have a problem with coal like they do with nuclear energy. And when asked about this, it was, well, we have a lot of jobs. They also, I think, have a lot of organized labor around that and around coal mining of lignite, as well as the actual plants that use it. So, you know, the question is, where is all of this power that all of these developing countries, where is it going to come from?
Well, that's a good question. I think the German decision after Fukushima was a very rash and ill-informed decision. I think at the time of that accident, there was about 17 nuclear plants operating in Germany, which was providing a significant portion of their electricity needs. And as you point out, shutting those plants down rather rapidly has resulted not in less carbon, but more carbon being generated and dumped into the atmosphere. So that has not helped the worldwide effort to try to abate and reduce the number of emissions around the world.
You know, when questioned about this, the Germans didn't really say what I hear Americans saying to me. What Americans say to me is, what about the waste? That's what they say to me. But in Germany, it was, what about Chernobyl? It was the accident. It was the particles drifting over from Russia. So let me ask you, you know, as people come to you and say, what about the waste? What do you say to that?
Well, maybe we can get some of what you just said about the aftermath of Fukushima we can address later. But getting to your direct question on nuclear waste, listen, nuclear energy is probably the safest form of generation of electricity known to mankind. And the result, and it also has an advantage, is probably the most intense form of energy. It's being safe, but I also said it's probably the most, what we call dense form of energy, and by that I mean the amount of energy released, which is vast compared to the amount of fuel necessary to produce that amount of energy. And so what remains is a infinitesimally small amount of waste, and this waste you can apply sophisticated treatment techniques, you can isolate it from the biosphere. As a matter of fact, from a scientific standpoint, nuclear waste is probably, after 1,000 years, is not any more radioactive than the original uranium ore from which it was mined. So it's a rather manageable, from a scientific perspective, it's a rather manageable issue. We have the technology to isolate the waste from the biosphere. It should not be the reason that we deny ourselves the benefit of using nuclear energy to combat climate change.
You know, I never really thought about that, Ed, that the waste is radioactive, but so was the original uranium, right? So that...
Well, everything's radioactive. The Earth's crust is radioactive. And everything, anything that's radioactive, basically, Mother Nature has a way of allowing it to decay to stable forms of elements. And it's just Mother's Nature. It's a process, basically, that Mother Nature has. And as you point out, uranium ore and lots of different ores in the Earth's crust are slightly radioactive and will be for millions of years to come.
You know, we're building the AP1000s at Plant Vogtle. I'm very proud of that and have been a big part of moving that forward. Though I don't know that we'll ever see additional AP1000s built in the U.S., I rack my brain and try to figure out who might do it. But it seems like this Generation 4, these advanced reactors that are being developed now, it seems like they may be received rather well, as because we do have people like Bill Gates and others involved. So what do you see as the future for advanced nuclear energy in the U.S.?
Well, I think you point out the AP1000, which is being built at Vogtle. It may or may not see additional units built. I believe there will be additional units built, perhaps in China and other places around the world that have urban centers that have to that need vast amounts of electricity. But getting back to your question, the light water reactor, which is a descendant from the nuclear submarine, the Navy nuclear submarine program, was a one-trick, what we call a one-trick pony. It produces electricity. The Generation 4, the technologies that are being developed today by the innovators and being fueled from the nation's national laboratories and academic centers like MIT, are basically have higher operating temperatures, and since they have higher operating temperatures, can do more things. It can provide process heat to produce chemicals, for instance, that can be in turn used to developing plastics and other articles that we use in our everyday economy. It can be used for radiolysis, for producing water, and many other applications. So the new reactors that are being developed provide an increased number of applications beyond just electricity that will make these reactors probably more economic in the end, and therefore probably more viable as far as our economy is concerned.
Well, we've been talking to Ed Davis of Pegasus Consulting, and we really appreciate you being on Energy Matters today and kind of bringing us up to speed on not only the history of nuclear energy, but its future. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Tim, and I'd be happy to come back anytime. Appreciate it.
Hey, this is Tim Echols. You've been listening to Energy Matters on the Road.
Gas South believes in the difference we can all make, like the difference in putting people first and showing that you care. For us, our difference is saving people money with our best rates and no deposit, and the difference we make in our community by taking care of our friends and neighbors and giving back 5% of our profits to help children in need. Learn more about what makes us different at GasSouth.com. Gas South. The difference is good.
Everyone has tough times in their life. By checking the Project Share box at the bottom of your utility bill, you can make life a little easier for your neighbors. Your $1, $2, or $5 checkoff is matched by the utility and then used by the Salvation Army to help folks having a tough time paying their energy bills. It's that easy. Join PSC Commissioner Tim Echols and many others by donating via your power bills this year. See more by clicking ProjectShareInfo.com. And thank you.